This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of December 28th, 2025. Hope you had a great Christmas. I'm recording this on Christmas Day by the shores of Boundary Bay in Delta, British Columbia, close to Tsawwassen, close to Point Roberts, Washington. And we're here for the last edition of 2025, and I thought it'd be a great time to have some of the best of 2025, some of the best clips of 2025. Of course, it's a year that began with a bombshell. Justin Trudeau decided to resign as Prime Minister, and for immediate reaction, back then in the first week of January, I had Mario Canseco from Research Co.
So last night over dinner, I told my kids about the decision that I'm sharing with you today. I intend to resign as party leader, as Prime Minister, after the party selects its next leader through a robust nationwide competitive process. Last night, I asked the president of the Liberal Party to begin that process. This country deserves a real choice in the next election, and it has become clear to me that if I'm having to fight internal battles, I cannot be the best option in that election.
It's the beginning of the end of Justin Trudeau. The election year is now underway with the resignation speech by Canada's 23rd Prime Minister on January 6th. What is your reaction to this announcement on the first Monday of 2025 that Justin Trudeau has finally seen the writing on the wall that he cannot get reelected?
We were in field over the weekend, Bob, and the numbers were dismal for the Liberal Party. 21% level of support across the country, the Conservatives leading in every region and province, with the exception of Quebec, where the Bloc was in first place, and the Liberals were a distant third. So certainly a situation where a lot of the things that we were told were going to happen were not materializing. We have no gender gap. The level of support for the Conservatives is the same among men and women. There was no significant rebound with middle-aged Canadians. We have a majority who say that they're voting for the Conservatives. And when we pose the question of a merged Liberal and NDP party in the next federal election, the numbers don't look good, either with Justin Trudeau as leader or Jagmeet Singh as leader. So it was just a matter of time before they realized that unless something drastic happens and they try to reconnect with Canadians in the next 90 days, it's going to be very difficult for the Liberals to hold on to power.
What were the key takeaways of the events of January the 6th, 2025, of Justin Trudeau's rushed announcement at Rideau Cottage to say that he was resigning? What are the key takeaways? Was there any surprise to you?
Well, there's a couple of things that were quite surprising. I think the discussion about Chrystia Freeland leaving the government left a lot of unanswered questions. You know, this idea of, you know, there are certain conversations that I had with her that I'm going to share with anybody. But also the notion that the regret is to see a situation where they weren't able to change the way in which we elect the House of Commons. And I was one of the people who actually presented to the House of Commons Committee on Electoral Reform. And I can tell you that the Liberals who were present at the time weren't really paying that close attention to this. I think most of us came out of this thinking that it was an exercise in lip service. And it ultimately was, because nothing happened. But, you know, to look at it this way and to say, you know, maybe this is my one regret that we couldn't do anything like this. And of course, we'll have a discussion about what the legacy of the Trudeau years will be. For some, it'll be the legalization of marijuana. For some, it will be the handling of the COVID-19 pandemic, which made today's announcement even more ironic. You know, this is the setting in which Justin Trudeau had a significantly higher approval rating discussing with Canadians how to deal with the COVID-19 pandemic in April, May, or June of 2020. And here we are 5 years later, and he's announcing from that same venue that he's stepping aside.
The former central banker of both Canada and England and the former chair of Brookfield, Mark Carney, won the Liberal leadership pretty handily, and he did not waste any time to go to the polls. Joining me from Victoria was Tristan Hopper, the National Post columnist, who wrote a book looking at Canada's decline over the 10 years of the Justin Trudeau era. His column, First Reading, is vital reading every day, especially during this federal election campaign. And he's the author of the new book. It's called Don't Be Canada, How One Country Did Everything Wrong All at Once. It's published by Sutherland House. It's darkly comic, but it's an accurate snapshot of Canada in the 2020s. Here we are in the middle of the 2020s. In a quote from the book, it says how one of the richest, most tolerant, and most functional countries on Earth decided to take wealth, tolerance, and functionality for granted. It's about how the most educated nation on Earth was convinced to go all out on unproven theories without considering the consequences.
It's not a partisan book, so you're not going to find the name Trudeau in this book all that often. But about 10 years ago, and particularly in the last five, the way Canada was being mentioned internationally started to shift. We were frequently mentioned as a model of what not to do. And I'd never really seen that before. So I saw this in terms of euthanasia and medical assistance in dying. So you saw this when the UK was considering doing its own medical assistance in dying. This actually came up at committee. They said, well, whatever we do, if we do the Dutch system, if we do the Oregon system, we should really avoid what Canada has done. Canada has really screwed this up, gone way too far, overlooked a lot of problems with the system that we should best avoid. You also saw that in terms of drugs, harm reduction, you know, Canada climbed second only to Scotland, just in terms of the raw overdose rates. We were number one in sort of, we were actually at the bottom of the list for the OECD in terms of hospital beds. We've of course been number one for housing unaffordability for years at this point. So it was just sort of an amalgamation of seeing all these instances just even mentioned in passing. There was actually the Financial Times had a story where it was mentioned the breakdown nations. So previously powerful and influential nations that sort of lost their global standing. And they said Canada is just the prime example of this. It's a Financial Times story. So it was just noticing that the way people perceive us, even the way people joke about us abroad. So 10, 15 years ago, you just, the standards, people who don't know much about Canada, maybe they'll have a joke about free healthcare. Maybe they'll have a joke about maple syrup. Now, the leading joke you're probably going to get is, are you really killing your elderly people? Or, you know, if you, the medical system is, if you got a cold, they're going to, I'm not doing these jokes justice. But it sort of started from that point, that very quickly, Canada went from a nation that either nobody thought about or we were seen as a place that was so well run you didn't have to think about it, to on a number of levels, and not just drugs, not just euthanasia, not just affordability, a whole bunch of things all at once, we became the worst example in the entire world. So it was my surprise at that which led to the book.
Point Roberts is separated from the rest of Washington State by water. It is connected to Delta, British Columbia. It is reliant on Canada for its utilities. I spoke with Brian Calder, who is the former president of the Point Roberts Chamber of Commerce, about Point Roberts being basically caught in the middle of the Trump trade war with Canada. And here's what he had to say about the difficulties that Point Roberts was going to face.
We don't need the cars. We don't need their lumber. We have massive fields of lumber. We don't need their lumber. We have to unrestrict them because stupid people put, you know, restrictions on, but I can do that with an executive order. We don't need anything they have. We don't need their dairy products. We have more than they have. We don't need anything. So why are we losing $200 billion a year and more to protect Canada?
We're the number one energy exporter to the United States from British Columbia alone, electricity, petroleum products, help fuel the United States. And so it's bizarre to me that we're having this conversation. It is solely to the benefit of China that the United States and Canada are feuding.
Now, Brian, what is the mood in Point Roberts with the new old president coming back and the tariffs that he's bringing with him? He's even talking about starting up a new bureaucracy, the External Revenue Service, to collect those tariffs. What will this do to Point Roberts?
Well, Bob, as you pointed out, we had a lockdown March 2020 for 20 months, and it devastated the economy of Point Roberts, which to this day has never recovered. We're trying hard, but we're finding that while all of the politicians in both sides of the border, every one of them has said, yes, we agree Point Roberts is unique. Well, if you look up the word unique, it means one of a kind. And one of a kind out of 400 million, give or take, on the U.S. side and 40 million on the Canadian side, that's pretty unique, all right. 440 million to one. And so, with this uniqueness, one would think that an intelligent mind would say, you know what, they need a unique solution, which is in fact the case. Are they providing one? Not one iota. It's strictly a military mindset at the border that says one size fits all, and it does not. And the evidence is painfully evident here on the road. I mean, there's just no traffic. Most of our economic activity now is limited to parcel posts, gas prices, depending on what they are and what the exchange rate is. And so, but we do get a lot of gas travel, but it's only 15 minutes and they don't spend that much. We're down since COVID, when we were down to like nobody coming through, we weren't allowed. But after it opened 20 months later, we were down 40. 35 to 40%, we're still down 25 to 30%. Well, when you think of what that actual number is, it's about monthly, consistently monthly, it's about 30,000 people or individuals coming to the border per month. If everyone spent $10, that's $300,000. If they spend 20, it's obviously 600. 30, it's close to $1 million a month hitting our market. So now, when you see what the president elect is proposing, a 25% tax on us, that'll be absolutely bring us to a standstill, just like the border was closed, at least economically, like the border 20-month closure on top of never ever recovering since then. And no one is giving up any thought to it, no forethought, no anticipation. Some of the premiers are doing that now, and I think your premier of BC, Eby, has said he's part of the thought process that says we'll have to retaliate if that in fact comes to into effect. And he has indicated that it might be in the areas of wood products, lumber, electricity and energy and water. And Point Roberts is served, as you know from previous discussions and having been here, that we are served by Canadian Water out of the Greater Vancouver District, Metro Vancouver. That's where all of our potable water comes from. We are served with BC Hydro selling their electrical power to Puget Power here in Bellingham. And then they broker it through the border. So if they ever shut those two off, it's lights out, obviously, literally. And the US border, in my opinion, would not be able to function because they're even hooked up not just to water and power, electrical power, but also to the septic sewer system. They don't have a septic. The rest of us in Point Roberts do have septic systems. They have into the Metro Vancouver sewer system and BC Natural Gas. So if all of those were shut down, God forbid, they'd be basically not able to function.
Lori Troutman is the director of the Border Policy Research Institute in Bellingham at Western Washington University, one of the foremost experts of border trade and tourism trends. And she came on the podcast to talk about the impacts of the Trump trade war on both sides of the border here in the area that is commonly known as Cascadia. And she also came on to talk about what that means as both Vancouver and Seattle get ready to host matches during the FIFA World Cup in 2026.
What data this year in 2025 versus data from 2024 is top of your mind? What evidence that you're seeing in the data that you analyze is top of your mind, as well as what you're seeing with your own eyes on the ground in Whatcom County?
It's a mix because a lot of the data that we would rely on hasn't really played out yet. I mean, we're hearing this a lot in the United States that we're just now starting to feel the impact of tariffs on consumer prices. So there's this delay between the data we would typically look at and this very fast-moving situation. One of the simplest metrics we can look at is just the number of border crossings. How many BC cars are crossing the border into Whatcom County. It's a simple measure, perhaps overly simplistic, but it does give us a sense of the trends that impact broader economic situations, broader business investment relations. And what we saw coming out of COVID was this steady recovery. The numbers, as I mentioned, dropped really, really low because of those border restrictions. And it took people a while on both sides of the border to resume that travel. But we were on a steady path to recovery, maybe still around 20% of pre-pandemic normal when it comes to that cross-border travel volume. And that was recovering month over month, including January of this year when the numbers were up, I think, around 15% compared to January of the year before. And then in February, that switched dramatically. And that is directly, I think, tied to the rhetoric of the Trump administration, whether it's the tariff threats, the claims about fentanyl and undocumented immigration, or the comments around the 51st state. We really saw Canadians react with ceasing their travel across the border. And that initial number in February of 2025 compared to 2024 was a drop of around 29%. And then we saw that number grow and it got higher and higher. And by April, we were seeing 50% fewer Canadian cars crossing into Whatcom County than we saw in April of 2024. That's a pretty drastic drop. We estimate around 5,000 vehicles, more or less, which probably translates to roughly 10,000 trips into Whatcom County. That's a lot of trips across the border. It's starting to recover slowly now. And I think summer is really going to be the telling time because that's our peak travel season as it is. I just ran the July numbers yesterday and we're down around 28% compared to July of last year. So we saw this really unprecedented drop early in the winter that seemed to continue to grow as I think Canadians got more and more frustrated and angry. Also border concerns in there as well. A lot of fear by Canadians around crossing the US border. And that seems to kind of be tapering off a little bit. The question is gonna be what happens in August, what happens in September? And is that 30% reduction sort of the new normal we're facing, or will we start to rebound from that as potentially the rhetoric dies down? But again, this is, sort of a glass ball, magic glass ball scenario where the rhetoric could die down, our trade relations could normalize, or it could get worse.
Kim Campbell was Canada's first female prime minister back in 1993, and she chaired the Vancouver Anti-Corruption Institute's annual conference at the Hotel Vancouver back in June, a conference about asset forfeiture, about white-collar crime and ways that the authorities can separate the proceeds of crime from the criminals. She chaired the conference. She had the closing speech, which we had on the Breaker.News podcast, and she had a lot to say about Donald Trump and his second presidency.
I want to remind you that the concerns about privacy are not foolish, because the United States has just given us an object lesson about what it means to have your country's data stolen. DOGE wasn't about government efficiency. DOGE was an opportunity to allow Elon Musk to bring in his little techies to download the data of all of the departments of the United States government, which has now then been passed on to Palantir, which is led by a man who does not believe in democracy, who believes that the country should be run by a CEO and a government of technocrats. He doesn't believe that women and people of color should have the vote because they're too liberal. One of the things he advocates is the elimination or what's the word I'm looking for, of the 19th Amendment, which provides votes for women. And if you think I'm being, people who know me, I am the least conspiratorial minded person, but I can't pretend I don't know what I know. I'm also a former Soviet specialist, which is why I look at Vladimir Putin and I know exactly what I'm looking at. But this is happening in the United States. These are people who also want to create a constitutional convention to get rid of the current American Constitution. It takes 34 states to agree to that. 26 have signed up. If that doesn't make your blood run cold, I don't know what does. So when we're talking about the protection of privacy, we need to realize that this is a complex and very sensitive issue. as Canadians, we have an opportunity to deal with it in ways. And that's why if we're all together and we talk about what would happen if we did this, what would happen if we did that, if we shared this kind of information, what are the guardrails we've put in place and why have we done that? Because we want to avoid a situation where a bunch of little 20-year-olds come in with their hard drives and download all the data from the International Revenue, the IRS, Social Security, all of the databases of the American government. I don't know where they are now. Are they in Moscow? Probably. I mean, quite seriously, we need to understand that our privacy and our respect for privacy is not some kind of left-wing woke fantasy. It has to do with the protection of Canadians, our ability to have some control in an era where we have very little control, you know, where Google is watching us, where everything we do on our phones, I mean, we're all, I think, pretty naive about how much privacy we have. But at the very least, our governments should not be complicit in undermining our capacity to have some kind of private life and identity.
The Breaker.News covered the first Web Summit Vancouver and produced an episode of the Vancouver Convention Center. One of the featured speakers was East Vancouver music mogul Jonathan Simkin, who helped make Nickelback and Carly Rae Jepsen international hitmakers.
I think the nationalism thing going on now is clearly a direct function of Trump's, you know, all of Trump's, you know, comments, which I probably should take them more seriously. I always can't help but kind of snicker a little bit because it's so stupid. Like, 51st State, really, dude? Like, that's really, you know, like, it all seems to be more an offshoot of an aging man with a huge ego that, you know, is just trying to grasp onto his own, I don't know what. So I don't know. I don't really, I mean, I'm very proud to be Canadian. I love living in Canada. I actually have dual citizenship because my mother is an American citizen and never revoked her citizenship. I would have to revoke my Canadian citizenship in order to get full U.S. citizenship. Not interested. Not interested. And I mean, you know, yes, we pay more taxes, but you know, like, there's a reason for that. And as much as there are Americans who like to shit on the Canadian medical, you know, try and act like experts, I don't know. My experiences with the medical system here has been pretty positive. You know, I had a son who was very, very sick when he was born, almost died. And the medical system saved his life. And if I was an American, I mean, I might have had insurance, but if I didn't, he would have died.
Duff Conacher, the co-founder of Democracy Watch, joined the Breaker.News podcast to talk about Mark Carney's multitude of conflicts of interest.
I kind of jokingly call the blind trust as it's constituted federally as an eyes wide shut trust. And to that, we saw on Grey Cup Sunday, Mark Carney attended the game in Winnipeg, and he was there for the Grey Cup coin toss at the start of the game. That was sponsored by Coinbase, and I looked it up pretty quickly, and his list of all his investments includes shares in Coinbase, which is a cryptocurrency company.
One of many ongoing, significant, direct financial conflicts of interest that he is in. He is literally a walking, talking financial conflict of interest. Very serious, very unethical, and he doesn't seem to care, and nobody in the Prime Minister's office or Cabinet office seems to care either.
There's got to be someone out there who's going to, you know, throw the flag and penalize him for promoting one of his investments in such a public way at one of the biggest sporting events of the year in Canada, one of the biggest TV audiences of the year in Canada, promoting actively one of his investments there by flipping the coin at the Grey Cup, of all things. That really did surprise me.
Yeah, and Conrad von Finkenstein, the current ethics commissioner, who in the first 6 months of his office buried 8 ethics complaints about Trudeau cabinet ministers and also weakened the ethics rules by interpreting them in weak ways in 3 different areas. I mean, this guy has said and made it very clear in his testimony before the House Ethics Committee that he is dedicated to facilitating big business, wealthy people getting into politics. And he's not interested in preventing, prohibiting, or penalizing conflicts of interest. The law itself is really the almost impossible to be in a conflict of interest act. It shouldn't be called the Conflict of Interest Act because it has this huge loophole where you can participate in decisions that apply generally, even if you have a financial conflict of interest and can profit from the decision. And 99% of decisions that the cabinet makes and the prime minister makes apply generally. So the act does not apply 99% of the time. So we have a law that's really just a loophole more than a law, an ethics commissioner who's not trying to uphold ethics standards, and a prime minister who has these financial, is a walking, talking financial conflict interest and doesn't care, and no one around him cares about that. He has as many conflicts of interest, financial conflicts of interest, as Donald Trump. And Canada's media has spent far more time covering Donald Trump's financial conflicts of interest and how he could be profiting from decisions he's making as president than it has covered Mark Carney, our prime minister. Canadian media, you would think, would be focused on our prime minister and his financial conflicts of interest. And really, it's hypocrisy from mainstream media outlets in Canada that they spend so much attention on Trump and his profiting from his position, and really has not even reported accurately that Carney is a walking, talking financial conflict of interest, let alone focused on how he could be profiting from the decisions he's making as our prime minister.
Just in time for the start of the NBA season, a gambling scandal, and it involved the mafia. A coach and a player were among the dozens arrested. Joining me on the podcast was Declan Hill, associate professor at the University of New Haven and author of two books on match fixing.
It also happens not only during the first week of the NBA season, but this is an era of the NBA that has embraced legalized gambling. The NBA is inching towards someday a franchise in Las Vegas. It has tournaments in Las Vegas. It also has corporate sponsorship with the likes of FanDuel and DraftKings and other gambling entities. It is helping sell the product to its viewers. It's basically selling its viewers to the gambling companies.
They've been dancing with the devil since November 13th, 2014, when Adam Silver, the then and current commissioner of the NBA, wrote saying that we should legalize sports gambling. I agree we should also regulate it effectively and properly and protect wide sections of our society that are gambling addicts or potential gambling addicts. But it's got to be regulated. And one of the things that's got to be regulated is the relationship between sports leagues and sports bookmakers. There has to be clear blue water between these corporations. How now can one of your viewers and listeners who's a sports fan be looking at a game, be it the NHL, MLB, NBA, whatever, and when someone makes a genuinely honest mistake, isn't in the back of their mind going, was that an honest mistake, or is there something else that's going on here? It really needs to be addressed, and it's not being addressed properly. Now, on that note, I'm going to be in Washington, D.C. on November the 6th, the local center to hear a guy named Richard Blumenthal, along with a Republican, have brought forward a kind of just basic regulation of gambling. And I'm shocked to say, once again, the Americans, I'm a Canadian, as you know, the Americans are well ahead of the federal Canadian parliament, both the Tories and the Liberals. We just need basic, simple, national regulation of gambling, be it at a consumer level, but also at the sports leagues level. And we also need to address the really serious gambling addiction that hits most athletes. Excuse me, not all athletes, but many in the athletes' world.
Well, thank you very much again joining me on the podcast. Declan Hill from the University of New Haven. And we'll have you on again to talk at length.
I'm a huge fan of yours, Bob. If there's anyone who doesn't like and follow the breaker news and would be followed by, you know, swayed by my opinion, I watch you, I read you constantly, even though I'm on the other side of the continent. You're doing fantastic work. So thank you.
Professor Christian Luprecht from the Royal Military College of Canada came to Vancouver as a featured speaker for the Vancouver International Security Summit. And he had a lot to say about geopolitics in this trade war era, as well as security preparations for the FIFA World Cup, which was discussed quite extensively at the Vancouver International Security Summit. Weapons that are being deployed on a daily basis in Ukraine, especially, there are concerns about drones being deployed at the FIFA World Cup 26 here in Vancouver and Toronto and the other host cities in the United States and Mexico. Where is this technology going, and are our governments going to be able to protect us from it?
Yeah, I mean, it's clearly dual-use technology. not just in terms of a technology of warfare, but a technology of disruption, right? If you look at the recent civilian the drone flights, for instance, over the Copenhagen airport that closed the airport, that Russia, that those drones likely came off the Russian shadow fleet, over Oslo and over the Munich airports, and the disruptive effects that that those have had. And of course, we're all familiar with the drone incursions into Poland, into Romania. We've had significant drone sightings over military installations in Europe, both for intelligence gathering purposes and disruptive purposes. But what's really one of the interesting elements that emerged in Romania is that, for instance, Romania did not have the legislative framework without declaring an act of war to shoot down those drones. And so one of the interesting questions is, how do we posture ourselves in a resilient fashion, right? Ukraine demonstrated that in an act of asymmetric warfare, it took out 20% of Russia's strategic nuclear fleet with a few drones that they smuggled into Russia. You know, so Russia lost more assets of their nuclear fleet in a couple hours than they had lost during their entire Cold War to accidents and anything else. So it was quite astounding the impact that you can have. And so certainly it's it has been a considerable concern, but it is now a growing concern, not even in the event of like an attack, but to the extent to which adversaries can use this to, you know, if you're an adversary and you know we use these gray zone tactics, you would simply, for instance, want to undermine the legitimacy of the government of Canada to provide public safety. So simply being able to run an illicit drone over Vancouver Airport or over one of the FIFA installations or so, and as a result, authorities having to take all sorts of precautionary measures, would have significant disruptive events, and the adversary would likely exploit that also in the information domain to kind of show that, look, countries can provide for their security and so forth. So it's definitely something that authorities are wrestling with, in addition to all the other security challenges that we already have. You know, if you think about terrorist challenges, you think about people with mental health challenges and the like. You think about, for instance, the movement of people between Canada and the United States during the FIFA World Cup, under the current conditions of the challenges that we have around the border, and movement around the border, and how do we issue people visas both for Canada and the United States in a way that's actually cohesive. Look, in terms of China, look, we run this huge port in Vancouver. You'll be familiar with the report that Delta has commissioned about criminal activity coming out of the port. We don't have a federal port police anymore, so there's a lot of debate about how do we secure the port. And the same way that the Russians flew drones off their shadow fleet just off the sea on Copenhagen, the Chinese or others could be flying drones off vessels right here in the port of Vancouver or out in the bay, sort of as you're pulling in. And so have we thought about, for instance, how are we going to make sure that the ships that we're admitting into our waters are ships that aren't going to be used for disruptive or hybrid purposes? Those ships can be stacked with communications equipment that can have serious disruptive effects. GPS jamming, which is the flavor of the day in the Baltic states, for instance, for civilian aircraft. Are we preparing the Vancouver airport for possible jamming activities of Chinese vessels off our shores here?
Also at the Vancouver International Security Summit, I spoke with Mubin Sheikh. He's a former Canadian Security Intelligence Service agent. He works with a group down in the United States called Parents for Peace, and he's a de-radicalization consultant, and he had a lot to say about the polarization in Canada that we see manifesting itself in street protests, very disruptive street protests in major cities.
We do have, in Western Canada as a whole, maybe not as much here as in Edmonton, for instance, a very large Ukrainian community. We do have a large Chinese diaspora, large Iranian diaspora, people that have left those countries to start a new life in Canada, contribute to Canada, and have seen this end up on the streets. Do you think that that's part of the message too? Is this also a case of foreign repression?
Yeah, or a way of intimidation, right? It is also telling those communities that we can bring the fight to your doorstep. You haven't escaped anything. A lot of these people still have family that are overseas that can be used, you know, as a way to intimidate the population. I mean, not everyone has come here with good intentions. All right, you have, we know who have been tracking this, like you have Iranian agents who have also come over here, Chinese agents who have also come over here. So it's unfortunately still a very active, it's narrative warfare, really, if you think about it. So for these diaspora communities in particular, it's they have to be very careful, because on one hand, if they are seen very publicly doing this, and then knowing that these foreign adversaries are collecting on what's happening here, they're checking to see who's at the protests, they're monitoring social media, they're hoovering up all that information, who's doing what, where, and you know, it's very easy to exploit these networks when you try to find the right influencer. Maybe it's give them a position, give them some money, give them some sense of ego fulfillment. It's a theater of operation. The streets of Canada have become a theater of operation for foreign adversaries.
Also on the Breaker.News podcast in 2025, we looked at provincial politics here in British Columbia. Alan Mullen, who is the chief of staff to the 2017 to 2020 Speaker of the Legislature, Darrell Plekis, joined me on the podcast to talk about some of the problems inside the NDP caucus. All is not well there. But as I talked with Andy Yan and Mario Canseco in the MMA roundtable, things are worse in the Conservative caucus. And as you know, things finally came to a head in December with John Rustad resigning as leader of the Conservative Party and Trevor Holford taking over on an interim basis.
Conservative infighting now, but what about NDP infighting? Is that around the corner? And should David Eby be worried, for instance, about that environmental wing of his party migrating to the Greens, who now have a new young leader, Emily Lowen? Should he be worried?
I think, first of all, I wouldn't be too concerned about Emily Lowen at this point. She doesn't have a seat in the House. I can't imagine either of the other two Green members are going to give up their seat for a by-election. And if they did, you know, she'd probably win in Spanish North and the Islands. I'm not sure she'd win West Vancouver, Sea to Sky, but that's besides the point. As Andrew Weaver said, she's very intelligent. She knows what she's doing, but she's very young, and I'm not sure the leadership is necessarily a threat right now. But listen, Eby has his own problems within his caucus, and you know, a certain amount of that goes with the territory. But I do know, even this week in Victoria, within that caucus, there's still, you know, quite a bit of chatter, certainly about Gary Begg. He's the member for Surrey Guildford, as we know. He was the Solicitor General and Minister of Public Safety for a very short period of time before he was essentially booted from caucus, excuse me, from the cabinet. So there's kind of, you know, a little bit of backroom speech about that. But interestingly enough, Gary challenged the Premier's preferred caucus chair, being Stephanie Higginson, and he actually won. He actually successfully, by a narrow margin, but he did successfully challenge her and took over as caucus chair. Within that caucus, and I think within, you know, the political realm, if you will, in Victoria, that's seen as a direct shot at Eby by Begg. So that sort of right there kind of shows you there is some folks in that caucus, you know, will they, you know, I think they've been around long enough. The NDP machine is sort of strong enough to make sure they don't say it publicly, but they have the convention next month and there is a leadership review scheduled for that. I also know there are some members in that caucus that plan to, you know, within the convention, challenge EB's leadership. And now that raised the question, well, who in that caucus would be A, prepared, or B, qualified to take over, number one. And number two, the nice thing about being in government, when you're the premier, and if you've got problems within your caucus or you're the leader, there's a lot of stuff you can do to distract. Because there's always something you can be talking about. I mean, Mike Farnworth has said there's going to be 18 pieces of legislation this session, which is a lot for a 6-week fall session. You know, he can constantly refer back to Donald Trump and the tariffs. He's now in a very public fight, if you will, with the premier in Alberta. So when John Rustad has problems, there's nothing really to hide behind, because aside from question period, all you have to talk about is the infighting and the misdirection within the Conservatives. Yeah. Whereas when it's with government, all they'll say is, yeah, but let me tell you about Danielle Smith, or yeah, but let me tell you about all this great stuff we're doing, or let me yell and scream about Donald Trump. And it does kind of distract. Does that mean there's not issues within that caucus? There absolutely is issues, and they're being talked about this week. I know that for a fact.
Yeah, Mario Canseco, here we are basically a year since the 2024 election. Research Co. was for many months before and has for many months since seen the big three double-digit issues. Really very little movement there. They're still on top of British Columbians' minds. They're still unsolved. Housing, poverty, homeless, economy, jobs, and healthcare. Those three, they might change position every once in a while, but go up and down, titch here or titch there, but it's really been the same. And we're not seeing David Eby fast enough solve those problems, and we're also not seeing the opposition come forward with viable solutions to really push the envelope. Here we are, it's almost been a year of nothing in many ways.
Well, I think the big difference is the level of organization from the opposition. You know, you look back at the late 1990s with unemployment rising, as it is right now, with labor disputes, as we have them right now, with people concerned about inflation and the cost of life, as we are right now. The Conservatives should be significantly ahead of the NDP. But I think it's become pretty clear that John Rostad is not Gordon Campbell. He hasn't been able to recover the rapport with voters that he lost during the televised debate. His numbers haven't been the same since. There has been a complexity in trying to connect with voters, particularly voters age 55 and over, who seem to be not overly satisfied with what the NDP is doing under David Eby, but not ready for the change that the Conservatives need from voters. I think that is the biggest difference at this particular stage. Your over 55 voter used to be a BC Liberal. It is now a BC NDP voter who is going to need a lot of coaxing to come back into the fold.
But I think what's interesting about the liberal or the conservative liberal, whatever they call themselves now, the conservatives, is that really it's actually how hard it's been for them to pierce the suburban urban vote.
Yeah.
Like that, I think that when it comes to the BC Conservatives, they very much do cover the kind of rural and northern areas of the province. But when it comes to the kind of vote-rich, seat-rich, urban and suburban areas, they're not able to pierce that yet. And I think that that's really, you know, one to kind of see whether they're able to do that or not.
The Cowichan tribes won a decade-long battle in BC Supreme Court back in August. One of the biggest stories in British Columbia for 2025 for so many reasons. They now have a title granted by a judge to land in Warehouse District, land in the Agricultural District in Richmond, even some residential land, about 800 acres or so. Now, the British Columbia government was pretty quick to say that it was going to appeal this, but it has a lot of people, not only in Richmond, but around the province, wondering if private property is no more in British Columbia under the NDP government, which enacted its own form of the United Nations Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. And joining me on the podcast to discuss this was Jeffrey Moyse. He's an Aboriginal law expert, used to work at the British Columbia government, advised five successive British Columbia governments on Aboriginal law issues, and here's what he had to say.
So people should be watching very closely what the provincial government does in the months and years to come, because could this be applied elsewhere in the province? Could other First Nations go to court and ask for and achieve the same type of decision and put people's private property in question?
Yes, on the basis of the Cowichan judgment, they could. They could challenge the private property interests. If a declaration of Aboriginal title issues from a court over those private lands, then what we know from her judgment, as long as it remains good law, and it is law today, what we know from her judgment is that the immediate effect of an Aboriginal title declaration over anybody's private property will be that the indefeasibility provisions that protect you under the Land Title Act have no application. So what have you got? You've got a fee simple which is thrown into question. The court hasn't gone so far as to declare it invalid. But what is it? it certainly is not protected, according to her, by the Land Title Act. So I'm not quite sure what you've got, but I'm pretty sure that it's diminished.
What should the public be demanding from their politicians at this crucial time?
My suggestion would be that the public should demand transparency from its provincial government. There's a lot of this that's been going on in total secrecy. Even the Freedom of Information legislation has created the ability for government to withhold any information that might affect Indigenous negotiations. So that means you can't even get access to this information through Freedom of Information. So I would say the secrecy is entirely problematic. And there are all kinds of negotiations going around on around the province where the government says it's negotiating Aboriginal title. Well, if it's doing what it did on Haida, that's truly frightening. But we know nothing about it. We're not told. And so I guess my last word for the public would be ask them, demand that they come clean as to what is going on.
So that's it from Boundary Bay, British Columbia. Just over my shoulder is Washington State. Point Roberts is nearby. Again, we've been talking a lot about border issues, about Canada and the United States, the relationship of these two allies, the friction that has happened during the start of the second Trump presidency, as well as what's to happen in 2026 when Canada and the United States, as well as Mexico, co-host the FIFA World Cup, the biggest sporting event in world history. A lot to look at. So thanks again for all my guests in 2025 and for all the people who logged on to watch or listen to the podcast or read our text coverage throughout the year. And you can become a member. Go to bobmackin.substack.com to become a member of the Substack newsletter. And if you become a paid subscriber, then you get early access to podcasts and we'll have more incentives to announce early in 2026. So thanks again. And Happy New Year. Sure.